Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Family Forever Child's Conversations on Care podcast. My name is Amanda Griffith, and I'm the CEO at Family Forever Child. This podcast is a space where we can hear directly from practitioners about how they are providing care to vulnerable children and families around the world. Family Forever Child is a growing network of 46 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 38 countries. These organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. In today's podcast, we'll be exploring the juvenile justice system in the USA. Given its sheer size, it's perhaps no surprise that the context for children in conflict with the law in the US is complex. And there's no one juvenile justice system, but rather varying definitions of what juvenile means in federal law and in each state. It's important to note that the US has the highest youth incarceration and confinement rate in the industrialized world, although this rate is declining rapidly. While the United States is the only United Nations member state that has not ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, there has, in fact, been a significant and sustained national drop in juvenile arrest and incarceration rates during the past two decades. This has seeded many changes in juvenile law and policy, particularly in the areas of deinstitutionalization, sentencing, and expansion of due process rights. Legal Services for Children, or LSC, is an organization based in the Bay Area of San Francisco, California. It provides free representation to children and youth who require legal assistance on matters including immigration, guardianship, child welfare, and education, in order to stabilize their lives and realize their full potential. LSC has been an active member of the Family Forever Child Alliance since 2017. In 2022, LSC was one of three Alliance members to take part in a research project on the topic of improving juvenile justice, which culminated in a multi-country report outlining key legal and policy issues impacting children in conflict with the law in Brazil, Paraguay, and the United States. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking to Nidra Schaller, who is the Legal Director at Legal Services for Children. Nidra, welcome and thank you for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to learning more from you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for allowing me to participate.
It's our pleasure. Nidra, maybe you could just start by telling our listeners about the context that you work in California and how the juvenile justice system is structured there.
Okay. So as legal director of Legal Services for Children, I actually support our attorneys. I support them in the work that they do, but I do have a sprinkling of cases where I support system involved youth, meaning youth that are in the child welfare system. And those youth who are working toward independence and stabilization. But as it relates to actually the juvenile justice system and our justice-involved youth, Legal Services for Children, we don't do direct representation. However, I believe that our finger is on the pulse of those issues that are impacting our justice-involved youth. And as it relates to how the juvenile justice system is structured in the United States and in California in particular, it really does depend on our respective counties. But let me give you an overall view. I believe that the juvenile justice system is a multi-stage process, meaning that there's the identification of some, and I'll just use the term delinquent, only because that's how we define it, but there's some delinquent and or criminal behavior. The next stage is that there's a referral to either a community-based organization for intervention, or there's a referral to probation or the child welfare system. Probation then does an intake of the case. And at that point, they can do diversion or they can refer the case to a district attorney to actually file a petition. Then the child is detained, usually within 48 hours of filing a petition. A child can be detained. And at that point, the court has to make a decision whether or not there's just enough facts to hold a child, kind of like an arraignment in a criminal matter. Mm-hmm. The next phase is adjudication, where the court actually looks at whether or not there's, again, enough facts there. Then the court looks at disposition to decide what's going to happen. And then there's some intervention about correction and then aftercare. So I'm going to break it all down, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. So the way California's juvenile justice system is, it's really a network of county and state agencies and community-based organizations and programs with the goal of providing services to our youth who are under the age of 18, who are believed to have committed a criminal offense. In recognizing the developmental differences between adults and juveniles, of which our system is designed to deal with youth who are under the age of 18 at the time of the alleged offense, the juvenile justice system was designed with an intended emphasis on education, guidance, treatment, and rehabilitation over punishment. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to local law enforcement, county probation departments and juvenile courts are supposed to work with local school districts and the child welfare departments and our behavioral health departments and community-based organizations all to develop programs and interventions intended to be treatment-based. I will say our county probation departments in the immediate counties that I'm thinking of are Alameda County and San Francisco County. They're responsible for operating our juvenile halls, our juvenile camps, our ranches, those entities that house our youth. And then at the state level, it's the Division of Juvenile Justice. And they historically have maintained three secure facilities for those youth that have committed more heinous crimes or alleged to have committed more heinous crimes. And then they also handle our conservation camp, when those are for like lower risk offenders. But like that, as of Saturday, the Division of Juvenile Justice closed its three facilities. And these are three facilities throughout the state of California. But they closed those facilities. And so now, youth who have been adjudicated to have committed these serious crimes, they now have to go back into the county, and the county has to create a place for our youth to be. And the county has to provide community-based services for them.
And so those children will therefore continue in their family during that, as part of that, or?
Not necessarily in their family, but the counties now have to provide resources and alternatives to I'm going to say incarceration or these types of facilities, or the youth have to remain at our juvenile halls. Whereas before they were separated.
Right. And what's the age of criminal responsibility in California?
So if you participate in an activity under the age of 18, and I say it that way as opposed to saying if you commit a crime, because again, alleged to have committed a crime. But then if you're under the age of 18, you can be adjudicated in our juvenile justice, in our juvenile courts.
Okay.
However, if the crime is of such a nature that the court and the district attorney and the court believes that it should be held in adult court, then the case can be transferred. You have to be, you know, over 16, but the court can be transferred to adult court. And then a young person can be sentenced to a penal institution where other adults are.
Even though they're under 18 still at that point?
Even though they're under 18, yes.
Interesting. And what's the youngest that you can come into the criminal justice system in California?
Honestly, I can't remember. And I say that because I know of a case where a six-year-old was, he was charged with a crime in our Bay Area. We ended up advocating that it was better for this young person to be in the child welfare system, but he was charged with attempted murder at the age of six.
Oh, okay.
We were able to divert that based on a psychological evaluation and just arguing that he didn't have the mental capacity to formulate, you know, the thought process around, you know, attempted murder. You have to have a certain mens rea, a certain, you know, mental element that just doesn't exist with a six.
Fascinating. So in terms of this, probably if we start to look at the new systems that are coming into place, which is fascinating to see, because this is very much, I think, where globally everybody is wanting the juvenile justice system to go, is much more community-based and looking at diversion and things like that. What are the sort of particular rights that children and youth have as they go through that system then at the moment?
So I would say that the children in our system, they do have varying rights, right? And in part because of the nature of the crime, in part because of the intent behind our juvenile justice system. It's not intended to punish, but it's intended to rehabilitate. It's intended to educate. It's intended to create, to help create productive members of society. So with that backdrop, you know, our youth have, of course, the right to notice of the charges against them. They have the right to counsel. They have the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses. They do have the right to remain silent. They have the right against illegal searches and seizures. So, you know, an officer can't just stop them. They have to have probable cause to stop them. If a youth has been arrested without a warrant, they have the right to a probable cause hearing, which is where the police have to show that they had a right to stop a person. They also have the right against self-incrimination. So they have most of the rights that adults have. The one right that they don't have is the right to a trial by a jury of their peers. Right. And there's a lot of thought around that. Right. It's in part because our juvenile justice system is not intended to be adversarial in nature. Right. It's not intended to be punitive. It's intended to be rehabilitative. It's intended to provide services. And so instead of having peers come in and participate in this process, they wanted it to be more informal. And then there's a whole other issue of what's a jury of your peer when you're 12, 13, 16, 17. So that's a whole other issue. So our constitutional
rights. This is very much then that are bringing together professionals to support. I mean, it sounds like the intention is to bring together all the professional services, be that education and social work and psychology and mental health provisions and presumably drug and alcohol support and things, to bring all of those together within the justice system to be able to think in a positive way how they can help that child or young person to shift their behavior away from the justice system. That's kind of what you're describing. Is that how it works in practice?
Right. So I think, yes, that is the intent behind it. And I think that the probation officer, who is supposed to be somewhat of an arm of the court in terms of the investigation, right? Yeah. They should be speaking to and getting information from the school and from the family. And if child welfare is involved, they should be getting information from the child welfare worker. So ideally, yes, all of the probation officers should have their finger in or their hand in rather, connecting with all of these different entities or people that are involved with the youth. And family, you know, I think the biggest thing is family connects.
Mm.
Right.
So would you like to explore that a bit more? How is that realized? Because obviously what happens in both the justice system and in professional services generally is that families who have maybe had very positive experiences of those services and previously, or who simply don't have the education and understanding of those services, can be quite disadvantaged in those processes, even though they are, so say, engaged. But what does it look like? How is it made so that families are genuinely part of that process? Or where are the shortfalls in your view on that?
So in my view, the shortfalls are in the initial conversations, right? So a young person can have allegedly committed a crime, and I don't think always probation officers go to find out, does this child have a disability? Does this child have a difficulty in making connections and understanding the consequences of their behavior? That comes about usually by having a conversation with the school setting. Because in our school setting, if a child has special education needs or a disability that impacts their education, there's going to be a psychological evaluation. There's going to be services that are available, but not always do our probation officers get that kind of information. And in part, they don't get it because they don't research it, but also because the families aren't engaged. The families aren't engaged because the probation officers aren't able to have those levels of conversations with the family. And I am speaking globally. I'm not speaking like, you know, this particular probation officer and this particular family, but that is the trend, that the level of conversation and community involvement and community resources is just not happening as much. I will say that when our governor decided to enact a piece of legislation which got rid of the three major facilities, the focus was around how do we get our youth back involved in our community? Mm-hmm. How do we ensure that community-based services are available to the family? How do we make sure that, you know, and it's real important because when it's all said and done, when they have finished whatever time the youth has had to serve, they're going to go back to their community. They're going to go back to their family. Mm. And so having the conversation at the outset about what kinds of services are necessary and what kind of services are available ensures a better outcome for the child. Because again, our thinking is we're not trying to punish our youth. We're trying to educate our youth. We're trying to provide them with services so that they can do better and make better decisions and make better choices. And that doesn't come with isolation and punishment.
And as you say, it sounds like a whole child response. It's sort of saying you need to look at all aspects of the child, not just focus in on a particular instance of criminality or alleged criminality, but actually look at the whole child and the community services that need to be around that child in a positive and supportive way. Which is so. And one of the things that's come out of the research, which I think is something that would be really helpful to explore, is talking about communities and community services and things, is that currently in the US is the quite significant overrepresentation of Black and Latino children and youth. And I wondered, so for example, I think it's like at the moment, statistically, 14% of all youth under 18 in the US are Black. But 42% of boys and 35% of girls in the juvenile justice facilities are Black. So what are the factors at play that is causing such inequity, do you think, in terms of that overrepresentation in the incarceration system?
So I think a couple of things that are causing the inequities. But I also want to give you another statistic that I found that's Remember the Division of Juvenile Justice, the organization that housed the three major facilities in California?
Yeah.
In 2020, it had 782 youth. Of that number, 464 were Latino youth, almost 60%.
Wow. That's
227 were Black youth, almost 30%, while only 60 youth were White youth. And some other statistics. Black youth are five times more likely to be referred to probation over White youth. They're almost 8%, eight times more likely to have a petition for criminality lodged against them, or, you know, petition filed. They're 10% more likely to be actually adjudicated a ward of the court, meaning that the court has to take jurisdiction over them and provide services and review their cases. And they're 31 times more likely to be committed to the Division of Juvenile Justice. That's for Black youth.
So we would describe that in the UK as institutional racism. I mean, is that your sort of assessment that this is?
Absolutely. I'm going to get there in a minute, though. And so, and so the statistics for Latino youth are kind of, well, so they're about two times more likely to be referred to probation. They're about two times more likely to have a petition filed against them. They're about three times more likely to be determined wards of the court. And they're about five times more likely to be committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice or the Division of Juvenile Justice. And so, actually, I thought about two different areas that I think feed this pipeline to the prison or pipeline to the juvenile justice system. As it relates to Black youth, I think it has a lot to do with our this push at a point for having law enforcement in schools. And so we call it the school to prison pipeline. And then as it relates to our Latino youth, it has a lot to do with, I call it criminalizing immigration.
Right? Uh-huh.
And so as it relates to police in school, and there's an entire push about fixed school discipline. Stop this pipeline to prison that's happening in schools. So there is an over-policing of our children in our public schools, and that's fueled this school-to-prison pipeline.
Mm.
Over the last few decades, police have become a dominant fixture in California schools. And their presence is having a devastating and discriminatory impact on tens of thousands of California students. And I mean, policing in the U.S. has its historical roots in slave patrols. It has its roots in forcing dislocation of indigenous youth to boarding schools. And so as communities across the country came together to reevaluate the role of police in enacting racism in the wake of the George Floyd murder by the police officers, there have been many advocates seeking to remove police from schools. And in significant, well, I'll say in the Oakland Unified School District, which is a predominantly Black school district, in Los Angeles Unified School District, in Pomona Unified School District, that's in Southern California, and in Claremont Unified School District, again, also in Southern California, those school districts have been able to fully eliminate policing in their schools or police presence in the schools. But there are some data out there that shows the harmful and discriminatory policing patterns in schools. Schools and police contribute to the criminalization of tens of thousands of California students. resulting in them being pushed out of schools and being pushed into this school to prison pipeline. So a couple of statistics or a couple of findings that were made based off of a report done by the ACLU. Black students' arrest rates are 7.5 times higher in schools with assigned law enforcement than in schools without. So typical conduct that could be addressed in the school, could be addressed by the principal, could be addressed by the counselor, could be addressed by restorative justice. Those activities are resulting in arrests. Right? Latino students themselves, 7 times higher in school, their arrest rates are 7 times higher in schools where they're assigned law enforcement than in schools without. And their referrals to the juvenile justice system is 4 times higher, almost 5 times higher. Also with regard to students with disabilities. And I think that that's significant because of their inability to process information the same way, to respond the same way, to react the same way. But their conduct, which is conduct that can be handled in the schools with the right resources, which are available, those students, their arrest rates are 5 times higher than schools that do not have law enforcement presence. So I can go on.
but what's fascinating is that what you're describing is that the same system has two completely different aspirations or intentions. So you talk about how the system is set up to be about education and guidance and support and rehabilitation, and yet the policing system, as you so rightly say, has this deep historical roots into something that is very different, which is the whole issues around slavery and then the other issue around immigration. So these two things are in complete contradiction with each other. And yet, so that the historical experience of where policing has come from as how it relates to particular communities within the US, and then also this aspiration for something that is supportive and educative and about enabling children to be rehabilitated, those seem to be very much in juxtaposition with each other and in conflict with each other, almost seems to be what you're describing. So building on that as its context, this shift now to closing down these institutions and looking much more at a community-based approach, what's that starting to look like in California? What do those systems reforms do look like? And are they going to be able to break away from those historical roots that has been proved to be so damaging and discriminatory?
So again, this all, the shift happened, they closed them on June 30th.
Sure.
I would like to see, like, do some research in the next 6 months to see how many of those 780 youth went to the juvenile halls and then the impact that that had, right? So, you know, I was thinking about this, and what I've come away with is there are practices that can be available, and then there are identified programs that could work with the certain practice. So for example, I believe that most youth who are in our juvenile justice system have some element of being a neglected child, or they could have been in the child welfare system where they could have received certain supportive services, right? And so identifying that factor, identifying the fact that there are these crossover youth, that there are some youth that need a lot of services to support them in the alleged criminal behavior that they are participating in, and that I see that could clearly work in that area is our juvenile diversion programs. coming up with diversion or alternatives to filing a petition or adjudicating a child as a ward of the court. Right. Another area is looking at the risk needs of a child. So developmentally, most youth aren't able to really assess the risk that's associated with their behavior. Cognitively, we're not there yet, right? Not at 12, 14, 16. It's just not there. I think there's lots of research on that. And so I see a program or having programs that are looking at the multi-system approach to addressing the risk-taking behavior that a child is engaging in, and having that kind of therapeutic intervention. Okay. I also think that cognitive behavioral therapy is a necessity. I think mental health treatment is a necessity. One of the things that our probation department does is they provide wraparound services to our youth that are involved. But those wraparound services also have to look at what other elements or what other factors are our youth are engaging in. For example, if our youth are engaging in the use of illicit substances, then actually addressing that issue, the why behind that, as well as providing the services necessary to address any type of drug use or alcohol use, or right? I also think that we have to get back to thinking about using the least restrictive policies. If our goal is to rehabilitate our children, educate our children, support our children in such a way that they stabilize their lives and can make independent, thoughtful, responsible choices, we have to give them the tools to do that. And that comes with having least restrictive policies, not confinement. Confinement can't be the go-to. That can't be the first place that we go. That's the last resort. And so I would love to see in 6 months, 12 months, 9 months, 12 months, how community-based organizations are actually now addressing the behavior of those individuals or our youth that would have been at DJJ now that they're at juvenile hall. And I guess my thinking is now that these youth are now at juvenile hall, the children that are currently at juvenile hall could be and should be shifted out into into the community in with family, within group homes, things like that. Again, going back to the least restrictive policies.
And as you say, almost sort of really minimizing the number of children engaged with the juvenile justice system and increasing the number of children who are in the child welfare system, because actually that's where the most change and beneficial changes can happen and where it's most appropriate for those children to be.
Right. Yeah. And even if not in the child welfare system, at least providing the same level of services that are available in the child welfare system.
Right. Exactly. With that sort of approach, with that sort of mentality that this is what is needed for this child. So just looking forward then, Nidra, in terms of where you sort of would say, well, what do you see as the key advocacy of this? Because this is a fascinating change point within the California system, and one that I think many people across the world would be sort of saying would love to learn from this, because this is absolutely the way that we've all been advocating for the juvenile justice system to change, is to be much more community-based and to actually have much greater spectrum of the child welfare and social services and mental health interventions, as opposed to the more classic juvenile justice interventions. What would you sort of say would be the sort of key advocacy focus at the moment that you would want to sort of call out?
Right. The key advocacy. All right. So I see moving forward, the biggest thing that we need to do is actually collect the data on as it relates to those youth that are coming back into our juvenile justice system, back into our juvenile halls, and actually seeing the level. I guess I would categorize it as the alleged crime, truly doing a psychosocial assessment in terms of the services that are needed, connecting with the family and building on the strengths of the family, identifying the strengths in the family and building on those strengths. Because it's difficult to hear that your child has committed a crime, right? And so a family has to take that in, digest that, accept that, and then make a choice to move differently. That's not going to happen within the 48 hours that a petition is filed. It's not. And so being cognizant, the professionals being cognizant that there has to be a mind shift in the family as well. Because at the end of the day, we want children coming back into society that are going to be productive members of society. And that's just not going to happen because we have separated a child for 6 months and we haven't identified the underlying problem or the underlying situation and actually addressed that within the family. So I think that's one thing that has to happen. I think that we have to have culturally competent programs, meaning that if a child is from a certain community, whatever that community is, and we know that that community has certain organizations, or we know that that family is tied to certain organizations, then we have to go out and include those organizations and entities in our planning. I'm just going to take an example. So let's just say that, someone is engaged in or is charged with burglary, right? We actually go out, we talk to the family, we find out what may or may not have been going on. We also find out that, you know what, this family is connected to a church and this church has mentors. Then we engage those mentors with the child in order to make sure that whatever services are being provided, whatever rehabilitative plan that's being identified, that it takes into consideration those natural familial elements that are already present. And sometimes we don't do that. I also think, that our trained professionals need additional training as it relates to being able to communicate with families, being able to communicate with youth, understanding the multicultural or the diversities within families and how all of that plays out. With regard to our youth that speak various languages, we have to understand that. And be cognizant of that and include that in our assessment of how we're going to approach our different families and our different youth. I think the biggest thing is improving our youth police relationships. I don't believe that placing law enforcement in schools in and of itself, we know that's not the resolve at all. But I also think that there once was a time when youth and the community at large had a different level of respect for police. But over time, and with the conduct of police officers and the overrepresentation of Black and Brown youth in our juvenile justice system, there's a deterioration of that relationship. And so I believe that it's imperative upon on law enforcement to do something different so that youth can have a different level of respect for law enforcement, if that makes sense.
It's brilliant. It really is. Thank you. And if I was to sort of pull out some of the key points in summary that I think that you've made here, that is really has relevance to wherever we are working. The first one is really to think about the historical aspects that inform both the juvenile justice system and the child welfare system. What are the historical root of those, and to understand those to be able to see where they are now. And so within the US context, that is rooted in slavery and rooted in immigration. But in other countries, it may be rooted in different things. But if you're going to make the changes, you need to understand what those historical bases are.
Correct.
And I think that the other aspect that you brought out, which is really important, is also to be aware of the fact that that you cannot apply any of the justice system as you would to an adult, that you have to acknowledge the growing capabilities of a child and youth. And what in that in reality, what a child is actually able to cognitively understand about their behavior. And therefore, any responses have to be within that context.
Yes, definitely.
And I think that the third aspect that you've brought out, which is very important, is around these are wraparound services, ensuring that actually that you can't just close down institutions. You've got to invest in heavily into something that is very much a strong safety network at the community level, and that has to be culturally relevant and appropriate, but that it really brings in, and it doesn't just focus on the crime, it focuses on the context of that youth and the family, and is a long-term process of really engaging with that family and bringing about and giving them the opportunities to be able to rehabilitate themselves or make different choices about their lives and as part of that community. And I think for me, those are the three sort of really crucial things that you've highlighted that are relevant to any parts of the world, quite honestly, in terms of looking at really sort of making changes to a system that, as we can say, within the US was deeply troubling the number of children that were incarcerated. But now seems quite that we are at a turning point in the US system, which is really exciting to see and has the potential to really be able to have some models for how others can really look at a much more progressive and positive way of responding to children in conflict with the law. So, Nedra, thank you so much for sharing all of that. I think that has been incredibly useful. And for all of those that are the audience that are listening to this, you can download the Improving Justice, Juvenile Justice Report from the resource library, which is on our website, familyforeverychild.org. And thank you to all of those that have been listening, as well as to Nedra for sharing such wisdom on these issues. And please do, if you want to, continue to join us in listening to this Conversations on Care podcast. But if you'd also like to spread the word and engage further in our conversations and activities, you can join our community on the Changemakers for Children community platform by visiting changemakersforchildren, all one word, .community to register. And the more users there are there, the stronger we will be to be a movement that is really progressive in terms of bringing about changes for children. So we hope you will join us next time. Thank you for listening and goodbye.